Welcome to Nature Now, an original production by KPTZ Volunteers. Nature Now is a program of information and insights about the natural history of our region. We welcome observations and suggestions from our listeners. Care of Nature Now at kptz.org.
Hello, this is Debron Kelso, host of this edition of Nature Now for the third week of July. My intended guest for this week was not able to make it. So instead, we have for you, as the core part of our program, an encore of one of my favorite shows of last year, a show that was recorded with Dr. Jerry Freilich, the former research coordinator for the Olympic National Park, as well as director of the North Coast and Cascades Science Learning Network. Jerry is passionate about environmental conservation and trained as an entomologist, and we spoke with him about biodiversity. We also have our faithful sound engineer, Charlie Fleischman, here to help us share current observations and upcoming events. Welcome, Charlie.
Hi, Debron.
But before we go any further, let's first hear the mystery sound of the week. A big hint for this one is that the wing clapping sounds are as distinctive to identification as are the vocalizations. We'll play it again at the end of the program and tell you what it is. I heard a commotion in my woods earlier this week, and I looked out to see a robin dive-bombing a Douglas squirrel. The robin actively pursued the squirrel through the treetops for a couple hundred feet, attacking it from above and causing it to leap for cover. I am sure that the squirrel had been busy trying to eat either eggs or young from the robin's nest. We tend to think that most animals have a specific diet. For example, we think that squirrels only eat nuts and seeds, when in actual fact many animals are opportunists and will eat many different food types. I remember being shocked to learn years ago that the adorable flying squirrels, whom we think of as vegetarians, as truffle eaters, were found to be one of the primary threats to marbled murrelet chicks, raiding their nests high in the treetops and killing and eating their young.
Nature Now originator Kate Dwyer wrote in a few days ago to tell us that the wildflowers are at their peak beauty right now up at Klahani Ridge in the Olympic National Park. She also mentioned that she saw a family group of female mountain goats and their young on the trail and gave them a wide berth. Goats, especially the males, can be very dangerous at certain times of the year, and it is best to stay well away from them.
I understand that learning about biodiversity has been a passion of yours ever since you were a boy, right, Jerry?
Absolutely. I'd like to tell you how I got interested in biodiversity, and then I'm going to explain what biodiversity is. But just to say that I grew up as a kid in Philadelphia, and when I was 7 years old, my parents took me to the Natural History Museum in Philadelphia, the Academy of Natural Sciences. It's our nation's oldest natural history museum. And I remember that first day when I was seven as though it was yesterday. It was love at first sight, instantaneous. And my parents were, well, city-type professionals. They were not nature people, or certainly not outdoorsy. They did not have any explanation for why I liked it so much, but I did. So what they did was, a couple of years later, when I was old enough to take public transit all the way downtown from our home up in the Northeast, they signed me up for summer classes at the museum. It was called the Junior Curators Program.
Oh, that's great. I would have loved to have done that when I was that age.
I bet you would. These classes met during the summer weeks. That was like a 4 or 5 week class. We would meet for 2 half days each week, like Tuesday and Thursday, half days. And each week they would talk about some natural history subject. But the most important thing was that we were introduced to the scientific staff of the museum. So the actual curator of ornithology and the curator of mammalogy.
That's huge.
And the curator of entomology. And this was so important. I became fanatical about this. I mean, my parents quickly saw that I was that way. And what happened as a result of this was I came to the attention of the curator of malacology. Now, probably most listeners have no idea what malacology is. That's the study of mollusks. And it turns out that the Academy in Philadelphia has the world's second largest seashell collection. Only the Smithsonian in Washington, D.C. is larger. Mm-hmm. I somehow drew the attention of the curator of malacology, Tucker Abbott, who's a very famous scientist and great author. Mm-hmm. And he took me on as a curatorial assistant when I was 11 and 12 years old.
Well, and if you've spent much time with kids, they are so observant. Probably you were great in the collections at noticing the differences between shells.
Well, okay, my job was very simple. Okay, the job I was given, I was only a tiny little kid, you know. But I was given the job a couple days a week. I could come down to the academy and I was unpacking these shells that were being sent to the academy from their expeditions all around the world.
Wow.
At that time, there was a lot of material coming in from the Philippines and the South Pacific Islands. So my job was to open these big boxes with a knife and then to unwrap these shells. They're all wrapped in newspaper with like Japanese writing on, you know. This was wild, you know.
Yeah.
And they had these weird smells and the shells were beautiful. And all I did was I unwrapped them and put them in little trays and put them in a row, in lines. And then I helped with the cataloging. I didn't have to identify things. But this job gave me the opportunity that no one else of my age would have ever had. That was, after I did my work, I was free to wander around the world's second largest seashell collection and open cabinets and pull out drawers, drawer after drawer after drawer of these most fabulous seashells. I mean, the world's most incredible things. It was a mind-blowing, mind-altering experience.
Well, and it's not surprising then that you became interested in biodiversity because it doesn't get much more diverse than that, does it?
No, but would everybody have that same reaction to this experience? I don't know. Let's just say that ever since I was 11 and 12 years old, I've been trying to explain biodiversity and its miracles, its wonders, to everybody I meet. It's been my life's work. Here I am, retired now. The events we're talking about were 60 years ago. And all those years, I've been trying to talk to people about biodiversity. So what is biodiversity? Okay. Biodiversity is the number of species in an area. So we can talk about the biodiversity of the Olympic Peninsula. We can talk about biodiversity of the United States, whatever. But it's the number of species. Now, what is a species? You know that there are different kinds of birds that come to your feeder, and most of us could name some common species. But what is exactly a species? It's actually a fairly complicated and technical question, with especially today's DNA techniques.
Yeah.
Systematists and taxonomists who study these things can get into a lot of detail here. But for our listeners, for right now, let's just use Ernst Mayr's biological species concept. Ernst Mayr's famous ornithologist who was at Harvard for many years, and his definition of a species was a species is a group of actually or potentially interbreeding individuals. That's what a species is. Mm. So all people are a species. We are one species because we can all interbreed with mm-hmm. one another. Lions and tigers are each individual species, even though they can be forced to interbreed in a captive situation, but usually the offspring are sterile.
Mm-hmm.
So a species has to be a group of interbreeding individuals or potentially interbreeding individuals. And
That are fertile themselves. That can reproduce.
And in the bird world, there are a bunch of ornithologists who decide what the species are. And those of you who are birders and among the listeners, you know that sometimes the taxonomists change their mind. There were Oregon juncos and slate-colored juncos for many years. Then the scientists decided it's all one species, and they do actually interbreed. And now they just call them all dark-eyed juncos. So that was a lumping together.
Uh-huh. And then sometimes we've got splitting.
And sometimes
also.
They split them apart.
Yeah.
But that's what biodiversity is.
But one of the major problems with recognizing biodiversity wherever we are is that most of us don't recognize anything but the most common species.
That is exactly right. What you just said has been basically the task of my life, to explain to people how diverse the living world around us actually is.
And you had a really great slide at your lecture that showed us five families of carnivores, right? I mean, things that were as radically different to even a child as cougars and wolves.
Right. Let me explain that slide.
Yeah, yeah. Describe it to us.
The first part about learning what we know and what we don't know about biodiversity is to get some feeling for the size of the problem. Let's just talk about some families of carnivores. The mammals, we're mammals, and all the warm and furry things you know about, those are all mammals. Most people know what mammals are. There are families that are within orders. And one of the orders of mammals are the carnivores. So in my talk, I usually show a picture that shows five different families that are in the order of the carnivores. And those five families are, I show a picture of a raccoon, the raccoon family. And I show a picture of a fox, which is in the dog family. And then I show a picture of a cat, which is in the cat family. And so on, the weasel family. But the bottom line is those are families. And no one would ever mistake a dog for a cat, or a cat for a bear, or a weasel for a raccoon. You don't need to know what the species are. You would just know that these are families and that they're quite different from one another, even if you don't know the species. So in my talk, what I show after the picture of the five families of carnivores, I show another picture that shows five families of houseflies.
And the audience is like, well, those look all the same.
That's right. These flies, if you were to look at the slide, now I would love to show the listeners a slide, but it's radio. We can't show you a slide. But just suffice to say that if you looked at this slide, you would see five pictures of flies. And our English language does us a disservice, because to you and me, those look like houseflies. If you saw one buzzing in the window of your house, you would say, oh, it's a fly. But no, they're not. To the entomologist, those five flies are as different from each other as the weasel, the bear, the dog, the cat, and the raccoon. They are different from each other at the family level.
Yeah, that's just
astonishing. And there's no common words. There's no common names for these. What I'm trying to get at here is there's this enormous diversity all around us. The differences between those families are based on tiny, tiny microscopic characters, but you have to have them under a microscope to know the difference. Uh-huh. You really cannot just eyeball them.
Yep.
Okay.
So how many species do you reckon have been described, not of flies, but of just
– Everything.
Everything. Yeah.
Well, here's another amazing thing. When we talk about biodiversity, it's very informative to realize that no one even knows how many living species there are to even an order of magnitude. So far as we know, there are about 1 million or so living things that have been named to date. Let's be generous. 1.3 million living species have been named. But scientists disagree on what the actual number is of things that we haven't discovered yet. The common estimate that you hear thrown around is that the actual number is something like 3 million species of living things. But there are other scientists, notably Dr. Terry Irwin from the Smithsonian, who has written and been on National Geographic and the Discovery Channel and so on, with his contention that the actual true number is something closer to 30 million. Well, now, okay, we don't even know if the number is 3 million or 30 million.
That's astonishing.
Just the fact that the uncertainty is so huge is in itself tells you a little bit about the magnitude of this sea of living things that surround us every day and about which most people, including myself and you, Deborah, are just completely ignorant.
Yep.
So, folks, you're not ignorant any more than we are, and the scientists in the major museums, we're all in the same ignorance, and all we like to think is that somebody cares about these living things because the living things, the biodiversity of an area, all fit together into what we call an ecosystem, which is like a living fabric of things. It's the fabric of life. It's the life that our lives depend upon.
We won't even go into the species that we know we've lost or the ones that we've lost before we even knew that we had them. What is the general breakdown of species? I mean, almost half the species that have been identified are invertebrates, right?
Right. It's probably true that most biodiversity now known, currently named, are probably insects. Actually, even more insects than other things like crustaceans. And my goodness, there are a lot of crustaceans and there are a lot of mites and there are a lot of soil nematodes. It's just amazing how much diversity there is. In the known named things, most of it is insect biodiversity. I think one-fifth of all the world's living species are beetles.
Wow.
And beetles are just one order in the class Insecta, in the insects. So there's orders of insects, and those have families, thousands and thousands of families. And each family has many, many genera. And each genus has either a few species or thousands of species.
Yeah, it's mind-boggling. So tropical rainforests are recognized as having the most biodiversity, with tropical ecosystems in general more diverse than temperate or boreal systems. But we still have an amazing amount of biodiversity here on the Olympic Peninsula, right?
It is absolutely true. As the research coordinator for Olympic National Park these last 13 years, I was honored to be able to see the work being done by all of these different scientists from all across the country. The stories I could tell are amazing. One group of scientists, for example, climbed a single tree in the Ho rainforest and found in that one tree 70 species of mosses and lichens.
Wow.
Just a single tree. 70 species. Now, in those mosses and lichens are thousands of little tiny orobated mites.
Worlds within worlds within worlds.
Worlds within worlds. Their soil up in the crowns of our Olympic trees, the largest trees, the old growth trees, they have soil that forms in the crowns of the trees. And there are little mosses and lichens and other flowering plants that root themselves in the soil in the crowns of the trees. And in that soil, there are mites, orobated mites, is this group of mites, where there are probably thousands of species completely unknown to science right now. I sent some of those over to University of Victoria, where Dr. Zoe Lindo worked on some of them. I don't know what her number is that she's up to now, but there were hundreds and hundreds of species in that little sample that I brought her. Just amazing. Well, and these are unknown to science.
New worlds. This would be a great time to talk about your magic number 15.
Now, whenever I talk to people about biodiversity, it helps when we're showing pictures, because the pictures, well, they give you an idea of what we're talking about. A lot of people, when they hear this conversation about biodiversity, one of the reactions is to throw up your hands and say, I just can't go there. I just can't deal with this. So what I try to do is to bring people back to Earth. And I'm going to suggest to your listeners that we think about what I call the magic number of 15. What I'm going to suggest is that the listeners hearing my voice right now make yourself a little goal of learning 15 new animals or plants that you don't know right now. If I asked you to name how many birds you could name right now, most people who, if you're not a birder, if you're not an existing birder, you've probably heard about orioles and tanagers and nuthatches and things like this, but maybe you don't really know them that well. What I would suggest is that everybody listening to me right now, make a task for yourself of learning 15 new plants or animals and learning about them thoroughly. Why 15? Well, the number is because if I said learn 10 things, the number is trivial. You can learn, you probably know 6 already and you add 4 to it and you say, okay, I'm there. If I said learn 20 or even 30, it's kind of a high number and you might get frustrated and again, throw up your hands before you got there. So 15 is a tractable number. It's not so large that you can't get your brain around it. It's not so small that it's trivial. If you are not a birder, learn 15 birds by sight and sound. You got to know both what they look like and what they sound like.
Oh, that's a great goal. Well, I'm afraid we've run out of time for today, but fear not. Jerry will be back with part 2 of this amazing discussion next month, and we're going to talk specifically about bees as a great example of biodiversity. So thanks so much for joining us, and we will start today on learning our 15 species for the year. Thank you.
Most of the fine natural history groups are taking a bit of a breather from scheduled events this week, but the Olympic Peninsula Audubon chapter invites you to join them for a field trip from Pitchop Pocket to Port Williams on Saturday morning, July 22nd. Go to olympicpeninsulaaudubon.org for more details.
And here's our mystery sound again. It's a band-tailed pigeon, and I chose it for this week's sound because I've been hearing them a lot lately, as they are now low in the canopy, feeding on ripe red elderberries. They are fairly common summer residents in our area, but are often confused with other species, both by call and by sight. People often mistake their call for that of an owl, or think that it is another species of dove or pigeon. Unlike the common domestic pigeon or rock dove, or the newly invasive European collared dove, the band-tailed pigeon is a native species and quite lovely. More slender and graceful than the domestic pigeon, with distinctive black-tipped yellow bill and yellow legs. It breeds in low-elevation mixed coniferous forests and feeds mostly on the fruits, seeds, and nuts of deciduous trees and shrubs. Though early in the breeding season, mineral springs and tidal flats are also important. Loose colonies of several pairs nesting together are common, with both parents feeding the young pigeon milk, a protein and fat-rich liquid produced in their crops. The loud wing claps of these large birds taking off from low in the canopy are very distinctive. And we'd like to thank the Cornell University's great CD collection, Bird Songs of the Pacific Northwest, for that lovely recording. And that's it for KPTC's Nature Now for the third week of July. Thanks very much for joining me, Charlie. And thanks to all of you for listening. Remember, if you missed any of our program or want to listen again, this program will be rebroadcast at 5 p.m. on Thursday, 11:30 on Saturday, and available as a podcast in a week or so at kptz.org. As always, happy trails!
Nature Now is produced by Nan Evans and edited by Charlie Fleischman.
Closing music is Fly Me to the Moon, sung by Frank Sinatra.
Fly me to the moon, let me play among the stars, and let me see what spring is like on Jupiter and Mars. In other words, hold my hand. In other words, baby, kiss me. Fill my heart with song and let me sing forevermore. You are all I long for.